Ready?
Well, today I wanted to touch on a little bit of what I call a philosophical approach to relationships. And I want to do that because as I've looked back over my career, I have found that in almost every successful thing that I have ever been able to do, there was an awful lot of relationships that were involved and a lot of help and a lot of people who were backing and so forth and so on. So I think it's important as a young person who is aspiring a career in any field. It doesn't necessarily mean it has to be in entertainment, doesn't have to be in business, needs to be, maybe he wants to be a doctor or a lawyer or whatever. He needs to establish relationships. I think I mentioned I know I mentioned that I worked at the Grand Ole Opry, and that was the last few years of my professional career. And I truly believe that that job was opened up for me because of relationships that I had established through my work at Opryland Theme Park. Because we worked, like in the Country Music USA show, Roy Acuff would come over and do a walk-on in that show. And so I had a good relationship with Mr. Acuff. And I think I'd said that I'd worked for the Minnie Pearl Chicken Company, and I had a really good relationship with Miss Minnie, or Miss Sarah Cannon, as her true name was, and others in the Grand Ole Opry, Jim Ed Brown and Porter Wagner and Bill Carlisle, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In every one of those situations, as we worked together to do things in the park, they got to know me, and I'm convinced that my dear friend, Bud Wendell, who was the CEO, he didn't just go out and drop Bob Whitaker's name on a dotted line. I'm sure he talked to some of those legends in the at the Grand Ole Opry as to what they thought about me coming over there.
Absolutely.
Even though Bud and I had hunted together numerous times and we had great conversations, he knew me. And he knew of my work in the park with the entertainers and so forth. So the relationships that were established in those opportunities, the communicating with those people, I truly believe was instrumental in helping me get there. I can even go back farther than that. When I went over to the entertainment department, I was reluctant to go because I was giving up 11-year career as an industrial relations personnel, human relations person. I went over there with some concern about what I was going to do. And I very quickly figured out that one of the things that needed to happen in the theme park for us to really grow our reputation in the show industry was that we needed permanent staff people who were there every day, watching shows every day, and correcting things that might be wrong or improving things that they saw. So I went to my boss, the general manager of the park, Giulio Pierpoli, and I said, "Okay, I'm over here, and I think that you need to let me increase the budget so I could hire permanent creative staff." And they agreed to that. Nice. So I hired two directors who did stage direction and writing. I hired a musical director who was incredible. He had performed on Broadway, played string instruments, is a fabulous jazz musician, but a really good arranger. And I hired a choreographer. Before that, all of those people were contract people, and they would come in and do a rehearsal. And they'd take off. They'd go back to L.A., go back to Chicago, or wherever they came from. And the stage managers were left there to maintain the quality of the show. And they did a good job.
Right.
But the creative staff was really important because the singers, the dancers, the musicians could look up to these people who had great credentials and so forth. And probably more important to me, I developed a relationship with the choreographer who is now my 41 years as my wife.
Outstanding.
So, that relationship has turned out...
I didn't know
out,
you met her there. That's tremendous.
So that relationship obviously was helpful to me.
Right.
But going on, I mentioned Roy Acuff earlier. Roy Acuff was incredible. You know, he had a great hit with Wabash Cannonball, On the Wings of a Dove, and many, many, many more.
One of my father's favorites, I have to tell you, Roy.
Right. And both of those were mine. And we named a ride after the Wabash Cannonball.
I remember.
the corkscrew ride was called the Wabash Cannonball. But one of the things that I was really impressed with Mr. Acuff, he didn't have to do this. He would go out into the park, find him a bench under a shade tree, and he would sit there and he would talk to our guests, the park guests who would just come in and they'd see him, they'd recognize him, and he never, ever refused to sit there and talk or sign an autograph or have a picture made.
How wonderful.
And I'm thinking, boy, what an asset that is. And when one of the things that I noticed about him, on his dressing room door at the Opry House, there was a plaque, and I'll never forget this, and I've used it for myself. There's nothing going to come up today that me and the Lord can't handle.
That was on his door.
That was on his door.
Wow.
Everybody that walked past his dressing room, they saw that. And, of course, we had a lot of guests that were backstage at the Opry. We did backstage tours. And see his dressing room. There's nothing going to come up today that me and the Lord can't handle.
That's tremendous.
And I've thought back on that many times. And there are some times when maybe I'd be a little bit down or not totally confident of myself. I'd go back to that phrase. So Mr. Acuff made a great impression on me just by who he was, how he related to the people in the park, just ordinary ticket buying people. And there are many others like that. And I'll just talk about Miss Minnie Pearl. Charming, charming lady with the hat with the tag still on it.
I remember.
Miss Sarah Cannon was a college graduate, and she graduated from Belmont College, and then she had a great career. One of the things that I remember about her, she'd sit down and she'd talk to the young people who we had hired in the park as aspiring young professional singers, dancers, and so forth. She had a say, and she said, "Never forget, on the ladder up to success, you may have to pass them on your way down."
Ah.
And so I thought about that, and I'm thinking, that's a relationship. Don't ever, ever think that you don't need this person or you just can ignore this person and it won't affect you. It very well might. So every person that we meet, we should meet with dignity, courtesy, and respect.
What a great lesson. Yes, sir.
And if we had more of that, our world would be a lot better.
Absolutely.
Minnie tells the story of one of the times that was a learning lesson for her. They had a date, and I believe this was in Pittsburgh. It was either Pittsburgh or Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And she and the band went up there, and it was terrible weather. Raining cats and dogs, and then the snow started falling, and there was ice and everything. And when the curtain went up, there was very few people out in the audience. So she says, "I made the mistake. I played to my band instead of the people in the audience, because there was actually more members in my band and people backstage than there was in the theater. Little did she know that the director and producers for a little-known Broadway play known Annie Get Your Gun.
Oh, wow.
Were sitting in the audience wanting to see her perform because she was on the list of people that they were considering for the lead in Annie Get Your Gun.
Offer that. Wow.
She met these folks after the show, and one of the people, I don't know if it was the director or the producer, he kind of chastised her and said, "You blew your audition." She said, "You played to your band and the people backstage and not to us." And then he says to her young folks in front, sitting in front of her, "I'll never forget that lesson." And she would advise them, never forget, you don't know who's sitting out in that audience. It doesn't make any difference whether they were paying customers or not paying customers. Someone out there may help you on your way to success.
Outstanding.
So never, ever forget that. Just another relationship thing that, and I will tell another story that we were the first, and I really mean this, we were the first American Idol group, or you can be a star group, because we had 14 shows, and some of them, 12 or 13 of them were double cast. So we had a lot of need for entertainers. We would hire 450 singers and dancers and musicians every year. And so to find those people, the best people, back in 1975, we were going out on tour to 36 cities. We'd go to New York, Chicago, Minneapolis, Boston, L.A., all over the country, having open calls, just like they're doing today on American Idol and on You Can Be a Star.
I was not aware of that.
We were doing that in 1975. And when we started the Nashville Network, I came back to the Nashville Network heads and I said, "Look, guys, you guys have got a great opportunity to go on audition tour with us and do some taping of the auditions that we have there out there on the road, some good ones and some bad ones.
Right.
But we're going to find a star." And we did find many, many stars out there on that road in open call. And it was not unusual for us to, like in New York, it was not unusual for us to go in there and audition for 3 days and see over 1,000 people.
1,000?
Over 1,000 people in 3 days. Tiring. It was hard on us. But we would sit there, and all of a sudden you would see that young person who had the, what we call, it. We knew,
yes, sir,
that they were a visual magnet. People would see that person physically. They would hear that person audio-wise, and they would hear them speak. And they would know, this is a person that we want to go see. And that's why we had so many people that were successful on Broadway. I can remember one time my wife and I went to New York, because she always would go to New York and still take dance classes, even after she was a successful choreographer. Who, by the way, she'll be mad if I don't say this. She has choreographed on cruise shows. She's done over 300 television shows, including the Country Music Awards show. She's done gospel shows. She's done everything.
And for those people listening, I just want you to know, Mrs. Whitaker will be a full interview unto herself as well.
At any rate, we were in New York, and we would always go to Broadway shows. We'd go to matinees and then go back that evening and see another show. And sometimes I got really tired of it, but she never did, because she could see people. There was one trip we were up there, and we gathered up playbills, and we had over 50 alumni from Opryland working on a Broadway stage in New York.
That is amazing.
And so that was a reward for us when we could see and it wasn't just the choreographer I'm the businessman. I didn't have a lot of direct input into their growth other than a lot of them would come to me and talk to me, and I would give them some fundamental philosophy for life and what they should be doing. And but she and the musical director and the writers and directors, and they had great input and great success in helping develop these young people. Unfortunately, in Music City, USA, there's no playground for young artists to be developed. That's with the closing of Opryland Park, and yes, you don't want to get me started on that. I've talked about Minnie Pearl, and I've talked about Roy Acuff. Bill Carlisle was never a huge star, but was a great entertainer. Bill Carlisle, he had novelty hits. He wrote songs like Old Knot Hole, Too Old to Cut the Mustard, and many, many more of those novelty songs. And his moniker was Jumping Bill Carlisle, because he could jump almost eye level to the microphone. But at any rate, I had a good relationship with Mr. Carlisle. And he wrote a tremendous song that has been covered by, gosh knows, maybe 15 or 20 artists. Ricky Skaggs and Kentucky Thunder had a tremendous hit with Gone Home. And Mr. Carlisle wrote
that song. I did not know that.
And the Grateful Dead recorded it. And Mr. Carlisle would say, "Well, I've never been a fan of rock and roll music until the Grateful Dead recorded my song." And he said, "I love them."
That's great.
A little interesting fact about relationships. Right after I became manager of the Grand Ole Opry, my assistant came in and said, "Mr. Carlisle's here to see you." And I had met Bill out in the park. He would come out there and eat and greet guests and do all that kind of stuff. So I said, "Well, bring him in." And he came in and he threw a literally threw a box of Russell Stover candies on my desk. And I said, "What's that for, Bill?" He said, "Well, you're the new manager and you're the one who decides gets to do the shows every Saturday night. And I want you to know I want a spot every Saturday night." And I threw it back at him and I said, "Take that in there and give it to my assistant. She's the one that runs this show."
Nice.
And so we got into a conversation and he said, "Mr. Whitaker, do you ever go up to Franklin, Kentucky and bet on the horses?" And I said, "No, I've never been up there." I said, "I'm not much of a gambler, Bill." He said, "You want a match for a quarter?"
"A quarter?"
I said, what? He said, "You want a match for a quarter?" I said, "No, I don't want a match for a quarter." I said, "If you want a match, I'll match for a dollar." So he pulled out a quarter and a dollar bill, and I pulled out a quarter and a dollar bill. And literally, we matched for that dollar bill. I won the first time. And I handed it back to him with a pen, and I said, "Autograph that." "What do you want me to autograph that for?" I said, "Well, you're a star. This is the beginning of my retirement fund."
Nice.
I won't ever do anything. It's my retirement fund. Mr. Carlisle and I, every single time, every Saturday night or Friday night, whenever we would see each other, he'd want a match for a quarter. He would also want me to sign. I said, "I know nobody. Nobody knows me."
Yes, you are.
And I never, never would sign that dollar bill. On his 90th birthday, they had a little luncheon for him at a little meet and three restaurant in Goodlettsville where we both lived. And I walked in, he said, "Hey, you want a match for a dollar?" And I said, "No way." But I said, "I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll match for $5. He said, "No, no, no." And I said, "If you'll match for $5, and if I lose, I'll sign it." He won. I signed his $5 bill. A few months later, he became ill, and I went to his home to visit him. And over his bed, pinned to the wall, was that $5 bill.
Oh, my Lord.
And that was quite a humbling experience for me.
That's amazing. Now,
it was pretty profitable because I have 223 autographs of Mr. Bill Carlisle.
Oh, that's great. So,
and I spoke at his funeral, at his death, and we became really, really great friends, and as did I did with many, many people. I'd like to mention Jim Ed Brown. One of the things that I'll never forget about Jim Ed Brown, if you don't know who Jim Ed Brown is, Jim Ed Brown had a big hit with Papa Top Again and several others, but he and his sisters had a crossover from country, number one in country, number one in pop, with a little song, Little Jimmy Brown or the Three Bells.
Right.
And Jim Ed and I hunted together, and we fished together, and we visited, and so forth. And every time I'd call Jim Ed's house, if he wasn't there, I'd get his voice machine, and this is the way he would answer it. Hello, friends.
Oh.
And every time he would go out on stage, he would say, hello, friends.
That's why I laughed. I remember that.
And so I'm thinking, what a great greeting. And he always had a smile on his face. Well, his lovely family asked me to speak at his funeral. And I walked out on stage, and I said, hello, friends.
Outstanding.
And the Ryman Auditorium was packed, and there was a big laugh. And his family smiled from ear to ear because everyone had heard that phrase from Jim Ed Brown. On his deathbed, he said, we've been friends. I don't want you to ever forget me. And I said, Jim Ed, I can never forget you. He said, I want to give you something. I said, you've given me friendship for over 40 years. He said, looked to his wife, and he said, Becky, give Bob the shotgun that my dad gave me when I was 16 years old. And she did.
Oh, my.
So, you know, I would not take anything for that shotgun. I've never fired it because I'm afraid I'd do something to it.
Right.
But I will never, ever forget those people like Bill Monroe and like Jim Ed Brown and Minnie Pearl and Roy Acuff and Porter Wagoner, and the list goes on and on. Jeannie Seely is one of my dear friends, and she's one of the standards at the Grand Ole Opry today. And she credits me with extending her career. She just turned 81. She's still performing.
Right.
She still does dates. But back in 1993, 94, 95, I'm looking there and I'm saying, there's no women that are hosting the 30-minute segments on the Grand Ole Opry. It's all men. And little did I know that sometime back in the 70s when there was an ice storm and she was the only one in the theater at that time, and she hosted the Grand Ole Opry. But
really?
That was the only time that she hosted. I could make guesses as to why.
Yes,
but Jeannie Seely, I made her a regular as a hostess for segments on the Grand Ole Opry. And she is still doing that today, 25 years later.
Amazing.
So, and, you know, she had many great hits. And I guess her first one was maybe her biggest one, a great song called Don't Touch Me. And 'cause you don't love me anymore.
Anymore. I know it, yes, sir.
So, any rate, I love the people at the Grand Ole Opry, and it was a great way for me to end my career.
Tell me something. Tell us a little bit about how the Grand Ole Opry works. How are the lineups set? You know, is there a hierarchy there? Or some people, is there a feeling of a brotherhood and sisterhood?
Well, there's certainly an affiliate of brother and sisterhood. It's a family. And if you talk about the hierarchy, it changes as the generation changes.
Right.
You know, Roy Acuff and Minnie Pearl. Boom.
Right.
That was the hierarchy. Miss Kitty Wells. That was part of the hierarchy, you know. Right. And Porter Wagoner then. He became the Grand Ole Opry spokesperson. And others as things transitioned. Here's the opera manager really had great control over who became members of the Grand Ole Opry, and it was by invitation only.
So it truly is that.
And I'm not sure how it is today, because
yes,
there's been two or three other managers since I left. I was the sixth one over 70-something years.
But Which in itself is remarkable.
So I thought there's only one way to know if they fit in with our family, and that is for them to do guest appearances. And, of course, the record industry and the publishing folks in Nashville, if they had a new artist that they were about to break and do so, they'd like to get them on the Grand Ole Opry.
Sure.
So,
be nice.
They would call and say, I've got a new artist that's just recorded a great hit. We think he's going to be big. Is there a possibility that he could do a guest appearance? Well, I would listen to the material that they would send, and I would have two or three other people listen to it. And if we thought it was Grand Ole Opry material, we would give them a spot on the Grand Ole Opry if there was an opportunity to. And if there was someone that we felt like was going to become a hit maker, we would ask them to come back maybe two or three or four times to do guest appearances.
I see.
At that time, we would watch their interaction with the audience and how the audience received
them.
And we would also watch the interaction with the family backstage.
Right.
And how they fit together or didn't fit together. And the respect that they garnered or gave. So those were the things that we looked for. The rule was they had to have at least one hit. So when they made a chart record and it played there a couple, 3, 5, 6, 10 weeks, that's an eligibility for becoming a Grand Ole Opry. And if they met what we felt like was enough guest appearances to show us that they fit the family, then we would ask them to come and become a member of the Grand Ole Opry.
I see.
There's no voting.
I did not know that.
No, there's no voting. You don't look and see how many hit records they have. You don't look to see how many people they draw to. It was, how do they fit our family? And there's been some successful people that have gone on and been big hits, big stars, that I never felt comfortable inviting to be members of the family.
That is so interesting.
I invited Joe Green. I invited Martina McBride.
What?
I invited Johnny Paycheck.
What?
I invited...
Oh, my.
I invited Diamond Rio. Which, by the way, Diamond Rio...
Who's who?
Diamond Rio, that group, we put together in Opryland Theme Park.
Are you serious?
That's where we put them together, one by one by one, put those guys together. And so when they became country music stars, it was a natural for me.
Sure.
To make them members of the Grand Ole Opry.
Is there a list anywhere of the members of the Grand Ole Opry?
Yeah, there is. You can go on the internet and
really
just type in membership of the Grand Ole Opry and you can see it, and it'll probably, you can probably go all the way back to when they started making members. That goes back to 1925.
So it basically, once a member, always a member kind of thing?
There's been a couple of instances, I think, where either the artist asked to resign, or maybe they were asked to resign. I never had that situation.
Okay.
I mean, who's going to ask Dolly Parton to resign her membership to the Grand Ole Opry?
No.
And what a sweetheart that lady is.
Is she in life?
Oh, my God.
So you hope that. You see her and you fall in love with her, but you just so hope that she's really that way.
Backstage, in the parking lot, she's exactly like she is on stage.
That is remarkable.
What you see is what you get. There's a little interesting story, and I think it's worldwide knowledge that when she decided to leave Porter and go out on her own, there was a little...
Yes, sir.
It really hurt Porter Wagoner, I can tell you that. And there was a little bit of anger at that time because he found her. He took her into the studio. He produced her records. He put her on his syndicated radio show and so forth. They had a great team.
Right.
Well, there was a time after Ms. Minnie Pearl or Sarah Cannon passed away, and the Sarah Cannon Cancer Foundation was created. And so one year, some people came to me and said, we want to do a benefit to raise money for the Sarah Cannon Cancer Foundation. And we'd like for you to chair the event. And I said, okay, I'd be honored to. So we're in a planning meeting one day, all the people around, and someone said, do you think you could get Dolly to come and be part of the dais? And I said,
oh.
Someone went, no. And I pulled out my cell phone, and I dialed her number. And she answered. I said, Dolly, it's Bob Whitaker. We're going to do a fundraiser for Sarah Cannon's Cancer Foundation. And we would like for you to be a participant in it and to sit on the panel. And she said, I would like to. She said, so how's it going to work? And I said, well, we're going to do a tribute / roast of Porter Wagoner.
Oh.
I said, is that a problem? She said, not a problem at all.
She said,
I'll be there, and you all can pay a tribute to him, but I'm going to roast his bony ass.
That is so great.
And it was, of course, that was all. And they were friends at that point.
Right.
And she would come and sing, I'll always love you, to him on stage, you know. And do
right.
So, but it was great. And she didn't let him off easy, I got to tell you.
She's
brilliant on stage, and that was wonderful. Well, what else do you want me to talk about?
Also, like, if were there ever times, or are there times, that an artist maybe late in his or her career calls and says, I'd really like to be on tonight or next week or whatever else? Like, Johnny Cash, I assume, is a member. Johnny Cash is not a member?
I think he... Well, he may be.
Right.
I'm sorry. I just need to check that out. If Johnny were to call and say, I'd like to do a spot on the Grand Ole Opry, I don't care who the general manager is, he's on.
They'd put him on, yeah.
Absolutely.
Right.
And I have done that in a couple occasions. But once a member, always a member, as far as I'm concerned. And I think that's historically true. And I one of the people that I really like and is a great opera member, and there are many of them, but Vince Gill, who is a relatively young member.
Yes, sir.
Even though he's been a member over 30 years. One night, Vince and I were talking backstage, and we were talking about the legends, the older folks who were still there. Maybe they're not profitable out on the road. They can't go out there and draw thousands of people anymore. But they still have fans. Vince said to me, he said, I hope the Opry never shuns these older artists who have paved the way for young dudes like me.
Outstanding.
And I've always loved Vince Gill, but I really became fond of him when he made that statement, because I grew up listening to those people who paved the way, who
exactly.
were legends. And there's a lot of artists who feel that way. You know what? It doesn't make any difference whether you like Garth Brooks' music or not. He is a member of the Grand Ole Opry, and he's a solid member of the Grand Ole Opry, and he loves the legends, and he loves the Opry. And I have never seen any other artist in any other genre who would love and respect his fans as much as Garth Brooks. Garth Brooks, when we would announce that Garth Brooks was there, if we had any seats empty, they'd fill up immediately. The sad part about that for me as the manager of the Grand Ole Opry was it would probably be 2:00 in the morning before I could close the doors.
Oh, I never thought of that.
Because Garth refused to leave the Opry parking lot or the Opry building itself until he signed everybody's autograph who wanted his autograph.
Wow.
I mean, sometimes from shows over at midnight.
Right.
Sometimes we've been in there at 2:00. people still wanting Garth Brooks' autograph.
And he stayed.
And he stayed. One night.
That's amazing.
One night he finished, one morning, I should say, he finished signing autographs inside the house. And the security people had told me that there's a group of people waiting outside the security gate wanting to see Garth and get his autograph. So I go up to him and I said, Garth, I can take you out the back way and get you to your vehicle and you won't have to go through the crowd that's at the gate. He looked at me and he said, how do I get to the gate? And he went right out there, stood out on the asphalt, signed autographs for everybody
amazing.
That was out there. He's an amazing guy. And again, I say, it doesn't make any difference whether you think his music is country or whether it's rock and roll or whatever. He is an entertainer.
Right.
And he loves his audience.
Extraordinaire. Absolutely. Talk to me a bit about backstage at the Opry.
Well, when it can be mayhem and it can be just the most fun, happy place you've ever seen. Backstage audience during my time, they were people who the artists would sign the register for, and they could come in as backstage guests of Jimmy Dickens, Porter Wagner, or whomever.
Right.
And back in the green room.
Is a real green room.
There was a real green room, and I'm assuming there still is.
Yes, sir. To the novice, someone who's never been backstage anywhere, you always hear about a green room, whether it be the John Carson show or the Grand Ole Opry.
In most cases, there's a green room in a theater. But in the green room at the Grand Ole Opry, in my time, we had chairs and benches and couches and free coffee and free punch and so forth and so on. And people visited there, and a local person would meet somebody from Michigan or Ohio or wherever. And you just saw a lot of conversation and friendships being made and so forth. And they could stroll into the different dressing rooms and say hello to the artists. And most of the artists would greet them, and they'd sign autographs, take pictures, and do all of that stuff. I'm a frustrated singer.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I am. I love gospel music. I love country music.
As do I.
My brother, who was also a frustrated singer, and I were backstage, and we with the Whites, Buck White, who is the father of Sharon, and Cheryl White, who make up the trio, the Whites.
The Whites.
Sharon is married to Ricky Skaggs. So we were backstage, and we started singing some of the old hymns, and we were just outside Bill Monroe's door, and Bill Monroe came out, and he said, that's really, really fine singing you have there. I just love the old hymns. He said, in 1934, I wrote this song, and he started playing some, it was an obscure song to me. Some people may have remembered, but he said, I wrote this song, and he went through three verses of a gospel song that he had written. And when he finished, we all remarked, that's really nice song, Mr. Monroe. He said, 3 weeks later, I wrote this one. Now, this is 1937.
Right.
3 weeks later, this one. And he sings another song. But it's that informality. Now, I do know for a fact that with COVID, they had to really strengthen the security of what was going on backstage and who could come backstage and
sure.
so forth and so on. So, and I understand that. But it was a fun place.
Who were some of the older members when you were there, other than the folks you've mentioned? I'm sure, when did Mr. Monroe pass away?
Mr. Monroe passed away in 1997.
So you,
it was either 96 or 97.
So you actually saw him perform at the Opry.
Oh,
I know that you were friends. I didn't know if you'd ever seen him.
Oh, yeah. Many nights.
Wow.
Many nights over the years. Mr. Monroe was a regular at the Opry. If he didn't have a show out of town, he was at the Opry. And we always put him on if he was there. We wanted Bill Monroe
absolutely,
and his band there. And he always thrilled the audience. And I had the great pleasure of visiting Mr. Monroe on his little log cabin porch many, many, many times. And we had a lot of conversation. And I don't know if I've ever told you this, but my wife and I own Mr. Bill Monroe's farm.
Outstanding.
And we still have his log house, even though we built a new one. But every time I drive into our property, I pass Mr. Monroe's house, and I think of us sitting on that porch.
I have cold chills. That's amazing.
I'll tell this story. Mr. Monroe and I were sitting on his porch one day, and he had game chickens on his farm, and they just roamed freely. And one day we're sitting there, and a beautiful, beautiful game rooster came strutting around the front of the house. And I said to him, Mr. Monroe, that surely is a beautiful bird. And he said, that fellow right there, he's something really special. He said, he can be flat-footed and jump 12 feet straight up in the air. And he produces the nicest chicks. I said, okay, Mr. Monroe, tell me the truth. Have you ever fought these birds? He said, no, sirree, that's against the law. Besides that, it's illegal. That's one of my favorite stories about Mr. Monroe. And I say that with love. And when I use his, when I try to mimic his voice, I do that with all the love in the world.
Oh, you can see the respect. That's beautiful.
And he was such a grand guy. And the whole bluegrass and country music feel misses him.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
How long had he lived in that cabin?
42 years.
So the last 42 years of his life, he lived in that cabin.
Even though he had another house out on the main Dickerson Road.
Wow.
He lived in that fat cabin on that farm.
Oh, the history. Oh, that's amazing.
And so he was one of the older folks that I saw all the time. I've had Don Gibson on the show,
gosh,
Jack Green on the show, Kitty Wells on the show.
That is just remarkable. You know, just a who's who.
If they were traditional artists and they wanted to do a spot on the Grand Ole Opry, they got it.
Great.
One of my great friends was a Cajun artist, Mr. Jimmy C. Newman. Loved that man. He had a beautiful farm out in Christiana, Tennessee, out near Murfreesboro. Had a lot of wild turkeys on it, and I loved wild turkey hunt. And I had the great fortune of him opening the gate to me, saying, anytime you want to come, do it. So I took a couple of friends, and we go out on a Saturday morning. We were hunting on his farm, and he met us. When I drove up at 5:30 in the morning, he came out on the porch fully dressed.
Wow.
Because he knew I was coming. He said, my friend, in his Cajun dialect.
Yes, sir.
He said, my friend, you got to be back here at 9 o'clock. Miss May have breakfast for you. 9 o'clock, it didn't make any difference. We were working a bird and had him right in front of us. So now we headed to
the
farmhouse.
In the pocket, you head back.
And she would fix the best Cajun breakfast that you could ever have. And so we became intimate, close friends, the family, Jimmy C. And I was honored to speak at his funeral also. But those are the things that are really important to me, is those relationships that we talked
about
earlier
today.
Going
back to the relationships, yes, sir.
And I just think that you never know. You meet somebody like you and I, John. We have developed a relationship that is beyond just friendship.
For me, for sure. Yes,
and
sir.
And for me. And so those things are important, and those are my fondest memories. I will say this. I've had people call me and say, we'd like to talk to you about writing a book. And I'd say, what kind of book do you want? Well, we'd like to have, I said, yeah, you want some good stuff and you want some dirt. Yeah, we got to have the dirt. I just pass on it. I say, this conversation is ended. There's no need for me to waste any more of your time or you to waste any more of mine.
What a great example.
So I've never written a book.
What a great example.
So these folks are too important to me. And my memory.
And you are to them, and you were to them as well.
Well, I hope so.
But I know so.
I would never, ever, ever disgrace myself or my friends to put out something in a book. The story about Mr. Monroe and the rooster may be the closest thing I come to.
That's a great story, though.
You know, so.
What's amazing about that, too, is we spoke the last time we met. You said from the time you were very young, your parents taught you not to speak ill of anyone else. And it's so funny standing here or sitting here with you, you know, 80 years in life, and you still go by that motto. That's really strong.
I respect my friends and I respect my relationships. I did a seminar for our management team, and I also took this topic, and I spoke at several college campuses, particularly to music education groups and so forth.
Yes, sir.
But this is true anywhere, and that whole topic was based around dignity, courtesy, and respect. And that is an inward thing too. You have to treat yourself with dignity. You have to treat yourself with courtesy, and you have to treat yourself with respect. If you don't, you're going to fall off the edge somewhere. You're going to find yourself in situations that you shouldn't be in, and it's going to affect your life.
That is strong. That is
so.
It seems like every time we are together, you say something that I have to really kind of put in my heart's pocket and think on longer. Knowing you has made me a better man. Now that is the truth.
That's humbling.
That is the truth.
Know, and if I've touched you, and you've touched me,
right?
And that's true. That's why we have a friendship. Why we have a relationship. I hope that extends to people around us.
Yes, sir.
Because that's the ripple effect is what will make and can make a community better, stronger, and the relationships will work for everybody. So if there are young people out there who cares to listen to this, you may think it's
folly.
There
are and there will be.
You may think it's folly, but it isn't. Trust me. You already know I'm 80 years old. I am in great health. The Lord's not through with me yet. And maybe he's speaking through me to somebody out there today. I don't know.
I think he is. I think he is. I have a question that I was asked to ask you about the Grand Ole Opry. Okay. So I'm going to do that.
Okay.
In terms of the dressing rooms of the Grand Ole Opry, are there permanent dressing rooms for certain people and then other dressing rooms that are for the folks that just come every once in a while and that type of thing? Is there any permanence at all in that area of the Grand Ole Opry?
Jimmy Dickens always went to the same dressing room, but there could be another artist who would go in there with him. Roy Acuff always had a dressing room. There could be other artists who would he'd invite to come in there and go with him. Porter Wagoner had a permanent dressing room in there. Hank Snow and Gene Shepherd went to the same dressing room every night. Now, were they assigned? Now, it just evolved.
I see.
And when we had guests, we would put them in. We would go to Grandpa Jones and say, Grandpa Jones, would you...
These names, you just took, you know, that's amazing.
Grandpa Jones was like me. He couldn't hear thunder. I'm deaf in the right ear, and I wear a hearing aid in the left ear. Grandpa Jones would be one of the first people that will come to the Opry House every night. He would be one of the very, very first. And I would, you know, I would kind of make rounds and speak to whoever was there, sitting there. I'd knock on Grandpa's door, and he'd say, "What say?" And I'd say, "Grandpa, it's Bob." "What say?"
And for those of you that are just, unfortunately, this is not on video. I wish you could see Mr. Whitaker's face as he does this.
So I would open the door and I'd go in and we would sit down and yell at each other because that's the only way we could hear.
That's great.
One of the fun stories about Grandpa, and I'm evading some of your questions, not intentionally, but it just reminds me of things.
Oh, that's fine.
Grandpa was out on stage one day, and he was hosting. One night, he was hosting, and he had already told his band, he said, "We're going to open our segment with this one, and then I'm going to introduce our two or three guests," however many was on his 30-minute segment.
Yes, sir.
"And we're going to close with this one." So when he got ready to kick off the close for the second one, the band started playing this, and Grandpa started singing another one, and he turned around and looked at him, and he said, "Eh, fooled you, didn't I?" Which was a great way to cover it up. You
absolutely.
Know? The audience got a big charge out of that.
Perfect.
So, you know, those little moments on a live radio broadcast. I mean,
right.
It's live. There's no backing up and saying,
right,
"Let's cut that tape." You know, it's
right.
Live. It goes out there.
It's funny, too, that you made the comment yesterday when you were talking about the rhyme in itself, that it was a church.
Yes.
Was it built to, were you speaking a literal church, or are you talking about the church of country music?
An old riverboat captain by the name of Tom Ryman got religion in Nashville, Tennessee.
Oh.
And he built the Tabernacle. And that's why it's named the Ryman Auditorium.
Wow.
And it was a church. And the operas had, the Grand Ole Operas had like five or six different locations.
Right.
One of them was a church. It started out in Studio A at the National Life and Accident Insurance Company's building.
Okay. I was going to ask you a little bit about that. So you're getting to one of my questions. I wanted to understand that.
One of the nephews of the Craig family, who were the founding fathers of the National Life and Accident Insurance Company, is an engineer studying engineering at Vanderbilt University, and he got enamored with this new thing called radio.
Huh.
And he built in his garage or his basement or in his room, he built a little radio station. And he could literally broadcast three rooms over or maybe next door or whatever.
Right.
And so he got the idea that this would be an opportunity for his family to sell more insurance. So he went to them with a marketing plan saying, "Let's build a radio station." And I think they started out with maybe 3,000 watts, maybe. I don't know what it was. I can't remember.
Would this be in the 20s? Or
1920. The Grand Ole Opry went on the air in 1925, so this is probably 23, 24 when he's building this and convincing the management to build a radio station. It happened, and they got the license, and they named it WSM, which was the motto of the insurance company. We shield millions.
I had no idea. In fact, you said yesterday how WSM got started. And that's one of my questions I was going to ask you. No idea.
We shield millions. That's WSM. So they went on the air, and they had Uncle Jimmy Thompson and a couple other pickers. Uncle Jimmy Thompson was a fiddler, and the story goes that they invited him to come up, and they turned on the power, and he sat in a chair and played fiddle for 3 hours. That was the first broadcast.
Live.
1925, live.
Wow.
And then each week, they'd add maybe Uncle Dave Macon or some of the other old-time back porch pickers.
Back porch, yes, sir.
And the studio started to getting requests for people to come in and watch and listen. So if you can imagine, it's probably a room much bigger than this. And there's 20 people there, and all of a sudden on a live broadcast, you've got three or four musicians playing old mountain folk country songs, and you get applause after each. It's not canned. It's live. And the Grand Ole Opry has not missed a Saturday night since 1925 through last Saturday night.
Are you serious?
Never missed a performance.
That is remarkable.
And so, 1925, they went on the air for the first time, and it was called the Nashville Barn Dance. And they, I think I mentioned that they went to LSN and hired George D. Hay to come and be a staff announcer for the Grand Ole Opry.
Yes, sir.
And what they did to fill time, they would do transcriptions of different things, different events around. And one of the things they did, they had transcription from the Metropolitan Opera in New York City. And it preceded the Opry, the Nashville Barn Dance.
Yes, sir.
So George D. Hay got out there one night, and he always started the show with a horn, a boat whistle. Hoot, hoot. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we bring you the Nashville Barn Dance. Okay, on this one particular night, the transcription went over its time. It was longer than they expected it to be. And
yes, sir.
He comes out and does his horn whistle and says, "Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to the Grand Opera from New York City. Tonight we bring you the Grand Old Opry from Nashville, Tennessee."
That gives me cold chills. That's how it started.
That's the first time that word was ever used.
Oh, my Lord. That is remarkable. I had never heard that. That is remarkable.
Story.
Wow.
And it grew from there.
Right.
The studio couldn't handle it in the building, so they went over to Fatherland Street into a church, and there's pictures of people sitting on benches and the upright holding the roof, and all those things are there. Then they went to the Nashville Memorial Auditorium, and I think there was one other place, and I can't remember that just exact. I should have done my homework. And then they went to the Ryman Auditorium, and they were there until probably 1970s.
So when did they go there? About what time? What year?
I think it was back in the late 30s, early 40s.
Okay, so they were there for a long time.
Yeah, they were there,
30 years
there
or
until
more.
1974 when we built the new Opry House.
Right.
They moved from the Ryman Auditorium and went the next. They were at the auditorium on Friday night, went to the Grand Ole Opry House at Opryland on Saturday night. That was 1974.
Wow.
And they stayed in the Ryman Auditorium until we went out to the Opry House. And because there's no air conditioning and there was a lot of structural stuff that needed to be done, it stayed empty until 1993 or 94, because it was during my term that we went in and rehabbed, put air conditioning.
So you still owned it?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
The company owned it. But the icon was too important to tear down.
Absolutely.
As a matter of fact, there was probably some city fathers who would wish that it had been torn down. But that icon is still standing, and it has been rehabbed. And there's lots of entertainment going on in the Grand Ole Opry now.
So you can still go there from time to
time? Absolutely.
I didn't know they ever...
Almost every week.
I did not
know
that.
There's concerts. There's lots of things that goes on in the Ryman Auditorium now. There's tours that goes on every day. And
I need to do that. My father, when he got back from the Korean War, his father... He was going to go to Tennessee Tech, and his father lived in Palmer, Tennessee, and his father and he went to, they had listened to the Grand Ole Opry forever on the radio, had never been, and they went to the Grand Ole Opry, that would have been, I guess, whenever the early 50s or late 40s, whatever, got back from the Korean War, and I would love, now that Dad's passed, I would love to walk in there sometime, knowing that my dad listen, my dad and my grandfather listened to a concert there. Well, that would mean a lot.
It's open for tours almost every day.
I did not realize that.
And maybe there's sometime I can, if I ever go back home to my farm instead of staying up here, I can meet you down there and I can take you through.
I can't tell you how honored I would be to just do it with you.
That's it's quite a place.
Yes, sir.
And it's fun to go to, and it's still acoustically incredible.
That's
it
so
is
amazing.
Unbelievable. You, I don't want to get in front of your questions.
No, please.
You asked me about the Grand Ole Opry, how it ran, and I got in to tell you how people got invited to join the Opry.
Yes, sir.
What happens is that you have a list of people who are going to be available to do the show on a given Friday or Saturday night, and you know that there are certain people that's going to be there every Saturday night, and there are certain people that you want to host. Like, I always let my Hall of Fame members, I always let them be host on the different segments. So if Jimmy Dickens was available that night, Jimmy Dickens is going to host that show. Okay, we've got two or three or four other artists who are not Hall of Fame members, but they're available to perform on that segment, and that's a 30-minute segment.
Yes, sir.
So you can put two other artists along with Jimmy on there. Jimmy will do an opening, he'll do a closing, and then you've got time to do two songs and two songs with other artists. So I'd look at the lineup and I'd say, who will be fun for Jimmy to introduce, and can they have rapport in the introduction? So that's who I would sign to Jimmy on those segments. And you would do that with Porter Show, you would do that with Ricky Skaggs, you would do that with Jeannie Seeley, who is a regular on there.
There's quite a lot of thought put into it then, really.
Well, yeah, it's, you have to think about the pace of the show.
Right.
You don't want to have a ballad singer come in there and put two more ballad singers with, and then you got 30 minutes of down-tempo,
right,
down-tempo music.
Right.
So
That is so interesting, and I had no idea. I'm an old baseball guy, so it's almost like a lineup card in baseball, how you want it. I have another question. This is totally personal. One of my dad's favorite artists, and you've mentioned him several times, was Jimmy Dickens. My dad called him Little Jimmy Dickens.
What everybody called him.
Why? Just tell me why.
4'11".
Are you serious?
That's
so
right.
He literally was
4'11".
That's amazing. I've always wondered that, and I've never seen a picture of him or anything.
Jimmy.
Dad loved him.
But I
so got
to tell
much.
You, he is physically 4'11", but boy, he cast a much bigger shadow.
My dad loved him.
He
dearly.
Cast a much bigger. He's from West Virginia, and he's from West Virginia, and he was a manager on the West Virginia High School, whatever it's like. I'll think of his little town. It bugs me that I can't remember that right now. But at any rate, he was a manager on his high school football team. He was too small to play football, but he was involved in athletics. And he's quite a character. Boy, I could tell you 100 stories about Jimmy, and some of them I would not write in a book. Did I talk about last, when we talked last, about a hunting trip that I took several Opry members on?
No, sir. You said that you would, when we talk later, you would bring it up.
Okay.
Or for me to bring
so,
it up, I'm sorry.
Mr. Wendell, the CEO of the company, started this tradition when he was the manager of the Grand Ole Opry. And the people who were hunters, who were members of the Grand Ole Opry, he would take them on a duck hunting trip, or he would take them somewhere else, whatever. But it was usually some kind of hunting trip, and Bud liked a duck hunt, so it was
usually
generally a duck hunt.
Right.
Well, I was a quail hunter, and I had quail dogs, and so when I started my stint as the guide or the leader of the hunting group, we went one year to a little preserve down in Shelbyville, Tennessee, for quail hunting. And it was an old farmhouse. And after dinner and after the poker games, everybody kind of sauntered out to different bedrooms, and there was two or three bedrooms upstairs, and like in a lot of the old farmhouses, the stairs had a 90-degree turn in it. You'd go up so many steps, and then you'd do a 90-degree and go up.
Yes, sir.
Jimmy went upstairs, and in retrospect, I wish and I had not let little Jimmy go upstairs. Because in the middle of the night, I was awakened by Mike Snyder. Mike Snyder shaking me. Bob, Bob, wake up, wake up. Little Jimmy has fallen down the stairs.
Oh, no.
And so I don't know what that means. So I jump up and run into the kitchen where they've assembled around little Jim. And he's standing there in the circle buttoning up his shirt, his fatigue hunting shirt. And with a gash over his over his right eye. I said, Jimmy, are you okay? He said, I'm okay, Mr. Whitaker. I said, and you fell down the stairs? And he said, from the top.
From the top. That is so great.
So the rest of that night, I took him to Shelbyville Hospital and to get his stitches in his head. So
the story's amazing, just absolutely amazing. These are treasure. They're absolutely treasure. And the great thing is, for many of us, we will have stories of our life, and we'll be able to tell them, and hopefully I'll be able to capture them for a lot of folks, and it'll mean something to family, their family, and maybe a few other folks as well. It's absolutely remarkable. And you said it best yesterday. I mean, it's absolutely remarkable how the circle of friends that you have had, and as I said earlier, I know why. I absolutely, when I asked you yesterday, and as I was listening back to our interview last night, our conversation, I wrote a couple of notes that I'm going to put into the introduction of these two interviews, and spoke about some of the twists and turns in your life, and some kind of a fascinating journey, but how through it all, the importance of listening to the small still voice, and how you've always done that, and it's just remarkable just to sit and listen and for your memories of people that we've all heard of, and really what you've kind of taught me through these 2.5 hours we've spoken is they're just people as well.
They're just people. Lovely people, marvelous people. And I think I said that when they first asked me to go over to do the entertainment people, I said, I don't want to go work with those crazies.
Crazies. Yes, sir, you did.
You know? And golly, I have made such great friends and relationship with those crazies, you know, and they're not crazy at all. They're everyday, solid, sound citizens who put on their pants one leg at a time, just like the rest of us. But you know what? It's okay. It's okay for us to see them as giants.
Right.
As legends. It's okay for us to do that, as long as we know that they're real human beings.
Valuable lesson. And one of the things that that I think is really neat as well, in my past life, I had the opportunity to meet a lot of athletes, professional athletes, and some folks that were involved in entertainment in terms of movies and things like that. And I so often walked away from those meetings a bit disappointed. From what you have said, it sounds like that I would say the vast majority of the folks that we would call country music stars are some of those good people you're talking about.
99.9%.
That's amazing.
You were a baseball guy. I got to share one thing for you.
Please.
It's a moment that I'm really, really proud of. The promotions manager for the Chicago Cubs called me one morning just out of the cold, and he said, we want to do a country music promotion at the park. would you consider bringing a few of the Grand Ole Opry members and coming up and doing a pre-game show and sing the national anthem and
wow.
do that at Wrigley Field? He didn't know that I played baseball in high school. It's my favorite sport.
And, yes, sir.
And I'm a baseball fan. And I said, done.
Absolutely.
So I contacted a couple or three of the artists that I knew were baseball fans. And there was seven of us and my family. I took my wife and my son. And we went to Wrigley Field, and I threw out an opening pitch at the Chicago.
At Wrigley Field.
At Wrigley Field.
That is remarkable.
And I have a Chicago Cubs warm-up jacket with my name on the back of it.
That is absolutely remarkable.
So, now, there you go again. It just is one of those things. You can't have that. You can't make that happen.
Right.
That was a thing where the promotion manager had respect for the Grand Ole Opry, and he picked up the phone and called the Grand Ole Opry and talked to me, and I benefited from it, benefited from my relationship with the Opry and with the artists.
What?
Also went into the booth and sang "Take Me Out to the Ball Game" with Harry.
No, with Harry Carey. Are you serious? Oh, my Lord.
Bill Anderson and I did.
Oh,
we sure did.
Now, is that Whispering Bill?
Whispering Bill.
Yes, sir.
Who, by the way, just celebrated his 60th year as member of the Grand Ole Opry.
He's still alive.
Oh, yeah.
I did not
still
know that.
Still writing songs.
That is outstanding.
Yeah.
Well, this is probably a great way to end this number two. I think there's probably going to be maybe a three and even a four, but by you talking about, again, benefited from where you were. Well, I want you to know, and I've said it a couple of times, and I'll say it many more, I hope, that many of us have benefited from the relationship with you. And I can't thank you enough for what you've done for me and my family.
The next time we talk.
Yes, sir.
I want to talk about the relationship that I had with your uncle, John.
That would mean a lot to me.
I want to talk about that. And because he and I were good friends.
Yes, sir. Anything you want to say before we sign off?
Thanks to all of you who will indulge me by turning on your radio and listening.
No, this is going to be great. Have a great day, folks.